All right, we are back and we are looking at this argument. And I finished premise D. Premise D is that there cannot be an infinite regress of contingent causes or contingent effects in existence. And the infinite regress does not mean that there can't be an infinite number of them. What the infinite regress, what the denial of an infinite regress is denying is that however many there are in the series, the regress must end in something that is uncaused. And the Western intellectual tradition, I think, is the pinnacle of intellectual traditions in the following sense. It was Aristotle and Plato that gave for us the need for a systematic, comprehensive worldview and a delineation of the laws of logic and rational reasoning. And what that Western tradition, and that's been integrated with the Christian tradition since the second century at least, I would take it back to Paul at Mars Hill, but we see this going on in the second century. We see a kind of mirror in epistemology and metaphysics. If you follow this argument out, what we're really saying is this: just as there are first principles in epistemology, like the laws of logic, beyond which you can't go, so the spade is turned. You can't go further down in terms of presuppositions, the laws of logic. And those are the first principles of rationality that begins our search for truth. So in metaphysics, you can't go further than an uncaused cause. And being rational has traditionally been defined as saying that there are no ultimately brute facts. There are no just things that exist without a cause but need a cause. And so what most atheists are caught in, and this is a kind of Vantillian point, but I think it's a very good one to make, all atheists are caught in a kind of rational, irrational dialectic where they want to say, okay, well, this needs a cause. Okay, well, what caused that? Well, I don't know. And so they leap to irrationality. And see, at the end of the day, if you don't ground all things in an uncaused cause, then what you're really saying is that all of reality is ultimately irrational. That's really what you're saying.
Does that not fall into the same, I guess, the Hindu perspective that all is illusion?
Yeah.
Does not follow the same?
I think that the atheist and the pantheist are cousins of each other. The atheist says all is ultimately irrational, and the Hindu says all is ultimately illusory. Well, what is the difference at the end of the day? Moving forward in this argument, premise D said there must be at least one uncaused, there cannot be an infinite regress of causes. And then on page 150, I give premise E, the cause of all contingent things cannot be caused by another. And premise F, the cause of all contingent things cannot be self-caused. And premise D really said that explicitly, and what I'm just doing with those premises is I'm just making explicit what was already contained in premise D. And that gives us our conclusion. Our first conclusion is that, therefore, there is at least one uncaused sustaining cause of the current existence of every contingent thing in the cosmos. I say, let us define cosmos as the sum total of contingent existences. Let us also assume that the cosmos has existed forever. Given our previous premises, we must conclude that the eternal cosmos has always been contingent upon something other than itself. For once contingent, always contingent. If something is limited, changing, and dependent, then it will always be so. If something is composed of actuality and potentiality, then there is something it will never have the potential to be, namely a thing with no potential. And if it is impossible for something that is composed of actuality and potentiality to become an actual without potential, then our contingent cosmos has always been and always will be contingent. But if the eternal cosmos is contingent, then it has been from eternity dependent upon a cause. To quote Aristotle, if the world is eternal, it is eternally insufficient and incomplete. It eternally demands a sufficient reason for its reality and intelligibility. And by sufficient reason here, we mean uncaused cause. Thus we have, or as Aristotle would say, unmoved mover, right? Thus we have the following argument. Something is contingent If something is contingent, it is currently caused to exist by another. The cosmos is contingent. Therefore, the cosmos is currently caused to exist by another. Hence, the cosmos may have always been, but it is not the only thing or collection of things that has ever been. Yet another argument for the fact that our universe is caused to exist by another goes as follows. Premise one, the universe is eternal and thus temporally infinite. Two, given infinite time, every possible state of affairs must have obtained at least once. I'll say that again. Given infinite time, every possible state of affairs must have obtained at least once. I want to stop there for a second. I'm basically taking the common atheistic defense of spontaneous generation and turning it on its head. What does the atheist tell us? And this is especially true in the 19th century. The universe is eternal, right? And a Christian would say, well, I don't believe it is. And then the atheist would say, okay, prove that. And the Christian would go, well, I don't really have any arguments. Because in the 19th century, the Kalam argument was not a staple in Christian apologetics. And so they would shrug their shoulders and say, I don't really have an argument for the beginning of the universe. And they say, okay, well, then you must grant that it's at least possible that the universe is eternal. And the Christian would say, yeah. And then the atheist would say, well, given infinite time, whatever can be will be. Because given infinite time, you've exhausted all the possibilities, right? Well, okay, I guess. Well, you would grant that it's at least possible, however unlikely. It's possible that somehow, somewhere, some way, life spontaneously generates in a primordial soup several billion years ago. Don't you grant that's a possibility? Well, I guess I'd have to. Well, given infinite time, then you've guaranteed that life will come into existence by pure chance somewhere. Why couldn't we be that world? Yeah.
But infinite time does not guarantee the move from potential to actual. In my mind, infinite time, regardless of it being infinite, cannot or does not have the energy or whatever the power to move what is potential to being actual.
Well, I guess what the atheist would say at that point is it's not just infinite time itself. It's infinite time and the laws of physics as we know them, and the sun, and the laws of motion, and this and that, all that stuff. It's possible that it would all come together in this one moment, so that you can imagine a primordial soup floating around and you have some phosphates and so on, and lightning strikes it, and 9 times out of 10 that lightning striking it, it's not going to create life, but maybe it does this one time. And you have to grant at least the possibility. So if you have infinite time, you basically increase your probabilistic resources to, from a low probability given a narrow stretch of time, say a billion years, to an infinite probability given infinite time, and therefore spontaneous generation becomes automatically a possibility.
Maybe, but where does your resources come from?
Well, if you believe that the universe is eternal and you don't have this argument that I'm giving you right now, the resources are just naturally eternal. They've just always been around. So if you say, where did you get your resources from? They would say, well, you're presupposing creation in that very question. They didn't come from anywhere. They just always were. And so from all eternity, matter was rearranged this way and that. And given infinite time, anything that can happen will happen. So given infinite time, life could spontaneously generate in a primordial soup somewhere. Now, that argument was very persuasive to a lot of people, so much so that a lot of people began abandoning Christianity as a result of it. Things have changed since then, and we'll talk about those changes in due time, but here's the point I want to make. Given infinite time, anything that can happen will happen, right? Let's take that premise and run with it. Is the non-existence of the universe a possibility? Yeah. I mean, if everything in the universe is contingent, and that means that everything in the universe could not be, in which case the real going out of existence of the entire universe remains a possibility. Well, given infinite time, anything that can happen will happen, and since the non-existence of the universe can happen, Why is the universe still here? There was an infinite amount of time for the universe to go out of existence. Right? So given infinite time, the universe would have already become non-existent. Because that's a possibility that would have obtained given infinite time. But that is false, for had non-being ever obtained, nothing would exist now. And that means there must be something that has guaranteed the continual existence of the universe from all eternity. So you can actually use that atheistic premise to prove that God exists. Now, we've not demonstrated that the uncaused cause is God yet. But that which is keeping the universe in existence from all eternity just is what Christians have traditionally claimed to be God. And we're actually going to delineate those attributes in just a moment. The cause of the cosmos is not contingent and thus caused, for then it would simply be a part of the cosmos. And it would simply be a part of the series of contingent effects needing a cause. And the cause of the cosmos is not self-caused, because that's impossible. Therefore, the cause of our eternally contingent cosmos is uncaused. And that means that there is an uncaused sustaining cause of the cosmos. At this very moment, the uncaused being, or group of beings, are actualizing the potential for the cosmos to be. Okay? So that is that premise, and that leads us to the next series of arguments, which makes the argument very interesting. The uncaused cause of contingent reality is eternal, necessary, immutable, independent, unlimited, omnipotent, and one, omnipresent, immaterial, omniscient, truth, omnibenevolent, love, life, impassible, and personal. And then the corollaries to that would be that he is transcendent and immanent, perfect and simple, immense, beautiful, happy, incomprehensible, and yet knowable. All right, so why, first of all, we say that this uncaused cause must be eternal. It must have always existed. A minimal definition of eternality is that you never begin to exist and you never will stop existing. Well, we know that this uncaused cause had to have always existed. Why? And by the way, there's a very simple argument for this. We're assuming that the cosmos is eternal. And since the cosmos has always needed a cause, the cause must have always been around to sustain it in being. It's very simple. So given the eternality of the cosmos, the cause of the cosmos must be eternal. I'm going to ramp up that definition of eternity in just a moment. But at the very least, you have to say that from moment to moment, this uncaused cause is endured through all infinite time and sustained the universe in existence. Okay? The next point, on page 153, I say the uncaused cause is necessary. Impossible things are those that can't be, and contingent things are those that may or may not be. A necessary thing is something that must be. Now, there are two ways to define a necessary thing in the Thomistic sense. A necessary thing is that which has an existence that is a part of its essence. Or, to put it even more clearly, there's no distinction between the essence and the existence of a necessary being. The essence of a thing is what is it, or its whatness. What is this thing? That when you answer that question, you're giving its essence. What is Travis Campbell? Travis Campbell is a human being that has two arms, two legs, blah, blah, blah. Son of Edgar Campbell. That's my essence. And the collection of the properties that I have all put together make me me. Well, then you can ask, well, is Travis Campbell? Does Travis Campbell exist? Well, you're talking about my existence there. You're talking about the that-ness of me. And the that-ness is clearly distinct from my essence, right? Because I could not be. And if I could not be, then there's nothing about my essence that must be. Right? So Clark Kent has an essence too. His real name is Kal-El. He goes by the moniker Superman and flies around, was loved with Lois Lane, et cetera, et cetera. But Clark Kent or Superman doesn't have existence. So Clark Kent is a being that contingently fails to exist. He's a maybe, but not is. and I'm a contingent being that contingently does exist. Right? No cause brought or sustains Kalel in existence, but there are a series of causes that sustain me in existence. That's why I exist and he doesn't. On page 154, I say, the book that I'm reading is a maybe, not a must-be. To be necessary is not to be self-caused, but self-existent. There's a difference in those terms. You just exist of yourself without a cause. A necessary being is self-existent in that it simply exists. It just is. It cannot not exist, and its essence is to exist. To put it another way, existence is a part of the very definition of a necessary being. Now, why contend that an uncaused cause has to be necessary? Well, the answer is found, for example, when we look at the definition of the word cause. What is a cause? A cause is that which actualizes the potential of another. Consequently, that which is caused to exist is that which has the potential to exist, and whose potential to exist is actualized by another. That which is uncaused, by definition, is an existence whose potential to exist is actualized by nothing. It simply exists. If the uncaused entity were a mixture of actuality and potentiality, then it would have the potential for non-existence. The potential for non-existence, if it were to ever actualize, would be actualized by either the uncaused being itself or by another. If by another, then it would be a cause rather than an uncaused entity. If by itself, then it would be a self-caused entity. For the existence of a being is caused by nothing outside of itself, but its potential for non-being is rendered possible only by itself, then its potential for existence is rendered possible only by itself. In short, a being that keeps itself from perishing in oblivion is a being that causes its own existence, but the cause of the contingent cosmos is neither self-caused nor caused. It is uncaused. Here's another way to put it. Is the uncaused cause a mixture of actuality and potentiality? Is it? What would it have to be if it were a mixture of actuality and potentiality?
A contingent being.
It would have to be a contingent being. And therefore, you can't say that it's a mixture of actuality and potentiality precisely because it's uncaused. Okay, so now you have two options. It is either purely potential or purely actual. Is it purely potential?
No.
How do you know that?
Because it actually causes all of the other contingent causes.
Get rid of its activities and focus on something that you say it actually
exists.
It actually exists. So it's not a pure potential. It is actual. So if it can't be a mixture of actuality and potentiality, and it can't be a pure potential, then it must be a pure actual or pure actuality. Right? Okay, and if it is pure actuality, then that means it doesn't have the potential for anything. It doesn't have the potential to be anything other than it is. Another way to put it is this. It doesn't have the potential to be non-existent. And if it doesn't have the potential to be non-existent, then it is necessary. It is actually necessary for this being to exist. It cannot not exist. All right. I'm going to move on to the other attributes. That should be clear, right? All right, so this being is necessary. This being, in other words, is pure actuality. On page 156, I give you another attribute. The uncaused cause, since it is necessary, is also immutable. Isn't that true? If you have no potential, that means you have no capacity for change. And if you have no potential for change, that must mean you are not just unchanging, but you are, in fact, immutable. You cannot change. And by the way, that automatically means we have to ramp up the definition of eternality. It's not like this uncaused entity or group of entities. We haven't proven that it's only one yet. It's not like this uncaused entity has endured through infinite time. Because why? Because time, by definition, is the measure of change in accordance with the before and after. But since this being is wholly immutable, this eternality of the being must not mean merely that it endures through infinite time, but that this being is really literally timeless. So there are no befores and afters for a purely immutable being, and therefore it is a timeless being. Another way to put this is to say that there's nothing accidental to this being's nature. What would it mean for a being to have accidental properties? You know, there are substantial properties and then there are accidental properties, or there are central properties and then there are accidental properties. Travis Campbell has a central property. For example, I am human. And I'll just give Aristotle's definition. A human being, by definition, is a rational animal. Take that property away from me, and you've destroyed the essence of what I am as a human, right? But I also have accidental properties, like two arms. If you cut off my arms, am I still human? Am I still me? Yeah. So what if this uncaused cause had accidental properties? Like it had properties such that if you took them away, it would still be what it is. Would it be immutable or mutable?
Mutable.
It would be mutable. It could change. Right? And therefore,
Unless you're saying that those things will not change the character, that is what you're saying, though, is it not? What you're
saying is that accidental properties don't change the essence of what it is.
Yeah, it doesn't keep me from being me, but it may change other things about me. It may change my character.
Or
right?
It may change what you're able to do in some aspects. If you're without arms, obviously you won't be throwing football. You won't be writing with your hands.
In other words, accidental properties are the very proof that I'm limited. The fact that I have accidental properties is proof that I'm limited and is proof that I'm changeable. So, in other words, if I am a limited and changing being, then that's what makes me contingent. So if you say that this uncaused cause has accidental properties, you're saying two things at once. You're saying that it's in time in some sense because it can change in some sense. And the only way you can change is to be in time. And therefore, you're not absolutely immutable. On page 157, I give you a fourth attribute. We've got eternality, and we've ramped it up to timelessness. We have pure actuality or necessity, and then we have immutability. This uncaused cause is also independent. That should be obvious, right? Is the uncaused cause dependent upon other things for its existence? Well, if it were, then it wouldn't be uncaused. The uncaused cause is unlimited or infinite. By this we mean that there is nothing outside of the uncaused entity that is able to place limitations upon it. We do not mean by this that the uncaused cause is an infinite number of things. It is not an infinite quantity. What we do mean is that the uncaused cause is an infinite quality. It is a being infinitely greater than the whole contingent realm. Indeed, there is nothing beyond the uncaused being that is able to place limitations upon its attributes, for it is completely independent of all else. Notice that in discussing the last three attributes of the uncaused cause, we have seen that it is the exact complement to contingent reality. Indeed, if contingent reality is essentially finite, mutable, and dependent, then the only thing that can serve as the necessary and sufficient precondition for its existence is an efficient cause that is essentially infinite, immutable, and independent. That is to say, one that is pure act. So pure actuality is a complement to that which is a mixture of actuality and potentiality, and unlimited, immutable, and independent is a perfect complement to that which is mutable or changing, finite or limited, and dependent. The uncaused being is all-powerful. That is automatically entailed by what we've already said. You were saying this earlier, Alex. You said that the uncaused cause has to have some capacities to sustain the world. Okay, now we're there. The very fact that the uncaused cause can sustain the world means that it has some power, right? Because you got to have some power to do that sort of causal activity. However, we just showed that the uncaused cause is infinite in its attributes. And therefore, in other words, you can't place limits on its attributes. And that means that it's all powerful. You can't place limits on its ability to cause or do anything else. So it's an all-powerful being that is pure actuality. And that entails, of course, that the uncaused cause is a single or unique thing. That means that it is one. And now here's why we believe that the uncaused cause is one. There can be only one uncaused thing, and hence the uncaused sustainer of the contingent cosmos is the only uncaused being there is. There are four reasons why we come to this conclusion. First, having concluded that an uncaused sustainer exists, we have found an adequate explanation for the current existence of the cosmos. To say that there is another uncaused cause would be to add a cause without warrant. Two, we have seen that the uncaused being is necessary. It is pure actuality with no potential. But to say that there is more than one uncaused being would be saying that the uncaused cause has a real potential for differentiation. However, as Geiser and Corjuan state, only what has some potentiality can be differentiated from another by virtue of the fact that they have differing potentialities or essences. Are y'all following this? In other words, why is human nature multipliable? Why can human nature be multiplied? Because human nature is a mixture of actuality and potentiality. It has the potential for differentiation. Okay? Pure actuality has no potentialities whatsoever. Therefore, what is pure actuality, say Corjuan and Geisler, that is the uncaused existence, must be one, since there is no way to make it many without adding to it what it by nature cannot have, some potentiality. Thirdly, the uncaused cause, as we have seen, is unlimited. Thus, the uncaused cause has unlimited or infinite causal power. But if there were two or more such beings, the infinite causal power of all of them would cancel each other out. Therefore, there can be only one unlimited being. And then if you flip down to the fourth one, I'm going to skip over some qualifications I give there. And on page 159... the principle of the identity of indiscernibles gives us another reason to think that there's only one uncaused being. And I've given you this example before. Imagine that you have a person that you run into, his name is Clark Kent, and you're like, God, he's the fastest typist at the Daily Planet and is in love with Lois Lane and blah, blah, blah. And then there's another really interesting character. His name is Superman, and he's flying around, and he's in love with Lois Lane too. That must be an interesting love triangle going on there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? Okay. Well, you begin to study them very closely, and what do you soon realize? You soon realize that there's not a single property that distinguishes Clark Kent from Superman. Superman will dress in Clark Kent's clothes and go to the Daily Planet under the name Clark Kent, and he will type very fast, and then he'll jump out of windows and turn into Superman and fly around. You realize that Clark Kent and Superman are the same person precisely because you can't distinguish their properties one from another, right? Well, what if there were two uncaused beings? That would mean that one uncaused being would have to have a property that the other uncaused being lacked. Right? That would mean that one of them would have something accidental to its character or essence, something that it need not have to be what it is, that distinguished it from the other uncaused being. But we've already shown that an uncaused being can have no accidents, and therefore there must be only one uncaused being. How are we doing so far? The uncaused being is omnipresent. This is on page 160. If you exist, don't you have to exist somewhere? isn't that an attribute of a thing that has to exist somewhere? But we've already said you can't place limits on the cause, right? So you can't exist somewhere without existing everywhere. So if you are uncaused, or if you are pure actuality, then you can't exist in a single location and not exist anywhere else, because that means that you would have to have potentiality. You'd have to be able to move from one place to another. You literally, if you are pure actuality, you have to occupy all space. All right, and then if you're omnipresent, you're obviously immaterial, because a material being, by definition, is that which is extended in space. I am material, right? And the proof of my materiality is that I'm extended in a single location. I am not omnipresent. So no material thing can be omnipresent, and therefore the uncaused cause must be immaterial if the uncaused cause is also omnipresent. Yes.
A distinction about the omnipresence that we are discussing here. So there is still a distinction drawn between the location of the uncaused causer and then the things which it is causing. In other words, even as it is present in the same place as that which it is sustaining, it is not in fact the thing that it is causing.
It is everywhere, but not everything. So there's a clear distinction between pure actuality and contingent reality at all times, even though you can't place limits on the awareness of the uncaused cause. And that's what distinguishes this from pantheism. We're obviously not saying that the uncaused cause is everything. Yeah.
And so, logically speaking, so, you know, apart from any context of scripture here, how would we go about explaining the notion of omnipresence? Because you're putting forth and proposing a being that occupies the same space as everything in existence. And so how can two things occupy the same space at the same time?
Well, I haven't proven that yet, because that argument presupposes the simplicity of the purely actual being, and I haven't gotten there yet. I've just proved that every part of God is everywhere, but at some point you're going to have to admit that God has no parts, and therefore he is uncomposed, and therefore he is immense. Just to leap into that, though, it's perfectly feasible for me to think that something can exist in, with, and through me and not actually be me. So there's a huge difference between existing concurrently with something, in something, and with something, and not actually be the something you exist with.
And so the existence that we're looking at is not a physical existence. In other words,
exactly. It can't be. If you said that God was a physical being, then you would automatically say that this being is located in a specific space. Okay, so what this has disproven is Mormonism and all forms of polytheism. So the idea that this being is immaterial as well as that this being is one has just knocked out the polytheistic worldview. And you'll notice that I'm going through the footnotes that each, you know, at some point you'll look down and you'll say, the viewpoint known as polytheism has just been refuted because we're knocking these worldviews out as we're going along. But yeah, so there's only one being that must exist everywhere, and if everywhere, this being must be immaterial. Cannot be a body, it must be incorporeal. This being is also omniscient. That means it knows everything. It knows any and all truths. In Volume 1, we define knowledge as justified true belief. And so just to give an inchoative point, if this being knows something, then it justified believes propositions that are true. So does the uncaused cause know anything? An affirmative answer is necessitated by the fact that this being is all-powerful. It is impossible for something to be all-powerful without having any knowledge. To be sure, the opposite is not true. That is to say, it is possible for something to be all-knowing without much of any power. For a being that knows everything may nevertheless be in a position to do nothing about it, or not be in a position where they could do anything about it. But a being who is all-powerful does not know how to use its power is a being who lacks a certain kind of power, namely knowledge. So knowledge is power, even though power is not necessarily knowledge. Therefore, the uncaused all-powerful being is a being who possesses knowledge. But then we also have to say that since this being is infinite in its attributes, it has to have all knowledge. It has to be omniscient. However, if the sustaining cause of the cosmos is wholly independent of all contingent reality, and if it is infinite, all-powerful, and all-knowing, then we must also conclude that it knows in a way that is different from the way we humans know. Humans know discursively via a process of moving from what is evident to us to what is not so evident. In order to know something, we move from the known to the as of yet unknown. But the uncaused cause, since it knows everything that can be known already, does not reason discursively. In fact, the uncaused cause does not even depend upon other beings for its ability to know. Its knowledge is independent of everything else. Our knowing ability is, by way of contrast, different than that of the uncaused cause, for we are dependent upon other beings for our knowledge. For example, if it were not for the sun, we would not be able to see and distinguish between colors. We know this is true of the independent being because it is pure actuality with no potentiality. A being who has no potential to learn anything. Therefore, this being, if it knows anything, knows everything. And its knowledge of anything and everything is in no way gained from something else. To give a common illustration presented by Cornelius Van Til, if we want to know how many socks are in the drawer, we must get up, go to the drawer, open it, and count the socks, and then come to our conclusion. The uncaused cause doesn't need to do all of that in order to know the number of socks in anyone's drawer. The one who is pure actuality just knows the answer without having to count. Its knowledge is a pure intuition that embraces all truth in one eternal act of comprehension. That should be amazing to you. To say anything else would entail that this being's knowledge is dependent upon something in the contingent realm, which contradicts the very nature of independent reality. What have we knocked out right there? We've killed open theism, and we've killed the doctrine of middle knowledge. The idea, because middle knowledge entails that God's knowledge is not purely a se, or from God. Everything we have said thus far, of course, entails that the structure of the all-knowing mind is not foundationalist, but coherentist. Now, Nathan, you remember a long time ago, back in when it was warm in the summer, we talked about two kinds of truth theory, foundationalism and coherentism. This all comes together right here, okay? We have to follow a foundationalist model for structuring our knowledge claims. Since we are finite, and hence must reason discursively from basic to non-basic beliefs, from the self-evident to the not-self-evident. But the mind of the all-knowing being is structured coherently. That is to say, the infinite mind has no standard of knowledge other than itself, for it need not look outside of itself in order to know anything. It knows itself through itself and even comprehends all things through itself. If you didn't say that, if you said that the order of knowing for the all-knowing mind is foundationalist, then that means you would make a distinction in it between basic knowledge and non-basic knowledge. You would make, and therefore there would have to be a standard of knowing beyond this being. But that would mean that this being is now dependent. So you have to say all of these things about this being. So this being's standard of truth is itself. It is its own standard of truth. Why? Because this being is wholly self-existent, wholly independent of all else. The infinite and purely actual mind is not dependent on other things for its knowledge. Therefore, its standard of knowledge is itself. All the infinite mind needs to do to know whether one of his ideas is true is simply correlate it with the other ideas within itself. If an idea coheres with or fits within with the overall system of truth within the infinite mind, then it is true. But it is even more amazing than this. For it's not as though the infinite mind possesses an infinite number of ideas, all disparate from each other. Rather, the infinite mind is so in a qualitative sense. In short, the infinite mind does not comprehend truth propositionally as if there were an infinite number of propositions in its mind. William Lane Craig summarizes this perspective as follows. He says, pure acts knowledge is non-propositional in nature. His is a simple intuitive knowledge that embraces all truth. Finite creatures break up the whole of what pure act knows into propositions which they know. But the fact that pure act's simple intuition can be broken down into a potentially infinite number of propositions does not entail that what pure act knows is an actually infinite number of propositions. His simple intuitive knowledge can be endlessly expressed in propositional forms without there being an actually infinite number of propositions which he knows. It's as though the infinite mind only knows one thing, one big fat idea that comprehends everything that can possibly be known. Thus, technically, pure act believes nothing and comprehends everything. That should blow your mind away. I'm going to give a brief defense of intuitive cognition here. We have offered a full defense of this perspective elsewhere, and that would be my dissertation. In my dissertation, I defend this view of knowledge of God. Here we will appeal to one argument that justifies our belief that the pure acts cognition embraces all truth intuitively rather than propositionally or discursively. Our contention, among others, is that this model of pure acts cognition saves us from Gettierian counterexamples. A number of years ago, a guy by the name of Edmund Gettier, shook the foundations of modern epistemology by offering several examples wherein a person was justified in believing a true proposition and yet still lacked knowledge of the proposition. This is kind of a funny story. Gettier was largely unpublished, and he actually had a meeting with Plantinga, and he was seeking tenure at the university he was teaching at, and Plantinga was basically giving him advice. And so Gettier said, I got to get some publications out before I can get tenure. And so Plantinga goes, do you have any ideas? He goes, well, I have one idea, but it's just so radical. I don't want my colleagues to know, that I've written this. And so what he did with that one is he wrote it in Spanish and released it to a Spanish journal so that his colleagues wouldn't, because a lot of people just don't know Spanish. So he kind of got around that. And then the other one, he goes, I do have this interesting idea that, justified true belief might not be the best or most adequate definition of knowledge. And so Plantinga goes, well, why don't you publish that? It was a two-page essay. And it shook the foundations of epistemology. People have been dancing around this table ever since. And he wrote this essay, and he says, and so I'm not going to summarize his argument here. I give the reference there. He wrote it for Analysis Journal way back in 1963. But if he is correct, then even an infinite mind could conceivably believe a true proposition with justification, construed however one wants, as evidence or warrant or whatever, and yet still lack knowledge of the proposition in question. On this account, even if pure act's mind justified believed all true propositions, past, present, and future, one could still conceivably say that it is non-omniscient. On the other hand, if we insist that knowledge for the infinite mind is not to be defined as justified true belief, but is rather to be defined as the intuition that comprehends all truth, then Gettier's examples do not apply to this mind. In fact, Gettier's example, his examples, further illustrate the very point we tried to make in Chapter 2 of this volume, namely, no finite creature as such can provide the sufficient preconditions for knowledge. Y'all remember that argument that I gave was very detailed? The same would go for the purely actual being if we define its knowledge as justified true belief. But if we conceive of its knowledge as intuitive, then we have found the fourth component necessary for our knowledge, if it is to be possessed by any creature. That is to say, if a creature is going to know anything, he can know the proposition just in case he believes it is true, has some justification or warrant for believing it, and the act of a purely actual, the mind of a purely actual being exists. Abrahamic theists traditionally have provided the epistemologists with a rich depository of ways in which the infinite mind grounds creaturely knowledge. As creator, God creates the human mind according to his infinite wisdom and places the human knower in an environment in which his noetic faculties can function properly. By the way, this is the first time I dropped the name God in this whole argument. I found it harder and harder to not use the word God. But I figure after I've established at least the omniscience of God, at that point, I'm sort of warranted in using that word. Although I'll fully justify it as the argument goes through. As knower, God pre-interprets all of reality for the human knower, who in turn reinterprets the world of his experience with the mind God has given him. And as sustainer, God keeps in being the environment of human experience, including the human mind, and ensures that at each moment the human knower is able to move from a state of ignorance to a state of knowledge. For it is in God's mind that we reflect and think and come to know. And so on page 165, I give you a model here that I actually lifted from Peter Kreft, who was another Thomistic philosopher. And you basically have the divine mind and his idea. Kreft said ideas, plural, but I think that God only has one idea. And that idea is of himself, and he knows all things through himself. And the contingent world that he decides to create is just known via this pure intuition. But when he creates, it spills out in time, one after another, right? So he's the author of all facts. And so what the divine mind does is it illuminates the human mind. And all material creatures in the world participate within the divine mind. And so, and then there's just a kind of reciprocity between the human mind and these material creatures. The human mind gains its ideas via divine illumination and its interaction with the world. It knows from experience. And so I think what's really going on is God, when we are created, when we're born in this world, we're born with the basic laws of logic and this and sense perception, and we begin to build a picture of the world from experience after that. And that's how we know things. And it's all happening because God exists. God is the coherent foundation for all of our knowledge. The divine mind comprehends all truth in one simple and eternal act of intuition. But this single truth can only be retained in the mind of a finite creature in a composed way. To put it another way, all of what God knows exists as one big fat idea, whereas human knowledge is broken up into small and skinny ideas. The divine mind illuminates the human mind with ideas discoverable through the natural realm. That is revelation. Some divine ideas may only be discoverable via special revelation. The divine mind also exists as the coherent background for the human mental structure and sustains the material world in such a way that as nature participates in God's being, humans are able to come to true conclusions by using sense perception. Thomas argued for this perspective in his teleological argument for God's existence. That is his fifth way, and this is what Thomas says. He says, "We see that things which lack intelligence, such as natural bodies, act for an end, and this is evident from their acting always or nearly always in the same way so as to obtain the best result. Hence, it is plain that not fortuitously, but designedly do they achieve their end. Now, whatever lacks intelligence cannot move towards an end unless it be directed by some being endowed with knowledge and intelligence, as the arrow is shot to its mark by the archer. Therefore, some intelligent being exists by whom all natural things are directed to." Repeat the, we're almost finished, and so you can.
I need to run a grocery. 2 seconds.
Okay, sorry for being cut off, but we'll just go back just a few words. And here's what Thomas says, just concluding or continuing the quote. "Now, whatever lacks intelligence cannot move towards an end unless it be directed by some being endowed with knowledge and intelligence, as the arrow is shot to its mark by the archer. Therefore, some intelligent being exists by whom all natural things are directed to their end, and this being we call God." Commenting on this text, Plantinga makes the following insight. He says, "Whatever lacks knowledge cannot move towards an end unless it be directed by some being endowed with knowledge and intelligence. we may construe this as the claim that there is no naturalistic explanation or analysis of proper function. If this claim is correct, and we have seen that it is supported by consideration of the main attempts to produce such an analysis, then indeed the way to be a naturalist in epistemology is to be a supernaturalist in ontology. That is the way, and here's his point, and I give the point in this footnote 44. Planning is addressing the issue of what it means to say that a person's mind is functioning properly. Indeed, one cannot claim to know something unless one has warrant for believing that his mind is functioning in a proper way. But the only way one can coherently entertain the very notion of proper function is if one thinks in terms of design. For example, my mind is functioning properly just in case it is doing what it was designed to do. And of course, the moment one begins to talk this way, you're functioning like a monotheist. I mean, what does it mean to say I'm an atheist, there is no God, and that my mind is functioning properly? What does it even mean to say that your mind functions properly in a world in which there is no God? Well, Aquinas later says this. He says, according to this opinion, then, on the part of the phantasms — phantasms for Aquinas are just like ideas or pictures in your mind. So on the part of the pictures in your mind, the intellectual knowledge is caused by the senses. But since the phantasms or ideas cannot of themselves affect the passive intellect and require to be made actually intelligible by the active intellect, it cannot be said that sensible knowledge is the total and perfect cause of intellectual knowledge, but that it is in a way the material cause. Are these ideas within the human intellect sufficient to ground the human knowledge of material forms? No, because Aquinas says that we must needs say that the human mind knows all things in the eternal types, since by participation of these types we know all things. For the intellectual light itself, which is in us, is nothing else than a participated likeness of uncreated light, in which are contained the eternal types. Whence it is written, many say, who showeth us good things? Which question the psalmist answers, the light of thy countenance, O Lord, is signed upon us, as though he were to say, by the seal of divine light in us, all things are made known to us. The psalmist also says in Psalm 36, verse 9, by your light we see light. Or, to put it in C.S. Lewis's famous words, I believe in God for the same reason I believe in the sun, not merely because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. Okay? He actually said that about Christianity. That was the actual quote, but I'm changing the quote a little bit for our purposes. So the last two attributes that we're going to be able to cover, and unfortunately we will not be able to meet again until January, so this is sort of the end hurrah of everything. And it really, we are going to round out the main attributes that monotheists have believed in one sense. I'm sad that I can't get to things like the simplicity of God, because I think they're so important, but again, we have forever, don't we? We can just keep coming back and learning. But let's go ahead and round out, at least get us to the three big ones that monotheists have always defended: the all-knowingness of God, the all-powerfulness of God, and then, of course, the idea that God is morally perfect or good, all good. Before that, we say that the omniscient being is truth itself. Truth is that which corresponds to reality, but notice that nothing can be more real than that which is pure actuality. Pure being, being as such, or simply the real. That's what God is to the monotheist. So if truth equals reality, then the real just is truth. We've also seen that the infinite mind does not measure its knowledge by anything other than itself. Its knowledge is wholly ase. It is its own standard of truth. It is the absolute, and the standard by which all other truth claims are measured. Thus, the uncaused being just is truth itself. And that leads us, of course, to this idea that the purely actual being is omnibenevolent or all good. And this is another involved discussion, but I think it's extremely important. The word good is so basic and intuitive to us that it, too, is difficult to define. A standard dictionary gives the following definitions: a general term for approval or commendation, suitable for a purpose, effective, efficient, producing favorable results, beneficial, salutary, fertile, fresh, unspoiled, uncontaminated, valid, genuine, real, enjoyable, desirable, pleasant, happy, like the good life, thorough, complete, adequate, ample, sufficient, morally sound or excellent, specifically kind, benevolent, generous, sympathetic, and so forth. Most of these terms adequately describe the uncaused cause, for this being is clearly efficient, since it is the efficient cause of the cosmos. This being is clearly a mind full of the ideas, or the one idea that has come to fruition in the world we see. Its mind is therefore very fertile. The uncaused cause is uncontaminated being, since it is pure actuality with no potential. This being has no accidents and is therefore complete, needing nothing else to be what it is. And this being is clearly generous, since it does indeed cause the present existence of each one of us. Out of the infinite bounty of its own being, it causes us to participate in being. In the divine being, we live and move and exist. Indubitably, this being is good. But is the uncaused being all good? Could it not be the case that this being is a mixture of good and evil? Just as many of the contingent things we see have some good and some evil within them, maybe the uncaused cause has both good and evil within itself. I reject this notion for the following reasons. When we look at what the word evil means, we have to say that this uncaused cause has no evil in it. One dictionary defines the term evil in the following way: morally bad or wrong, wicked, depraved, resulting from or based on conduct regarded as immoral, offensive or disgusting, like an evil odor, threatening or bringing misfortune, unlucky, disastrous, unfortunate. Notice that the term evil carries with it the connotation of being depraved, and when we look up that term, we encounter words like corrupt, contamination, deterioration, perverted, debased, which means that which is lacking in quality, value, and dignity. Since these are the terms still generally associated with evil, Augustine is hardly to be blamed when he tells us that evil is that which falls away from essence and tends to non-existence. Indeed, evil is not to be defined in a positive way, but is rather a negative term denoting a loss of goodness. For evil has no positive nature, he says, but the loss of good has received the name evil. Concerning those who define evil as corruption, Augustine writes, undeniably, this is a general definition of evil, for corruption implies opposition to nature and also hurt. But corruption exists not by itself, but in some substance which it corrupts, for corruption itself is not a substance. Evil, then, is not a thing, but the contamination or corruption of a thing. It is a privation of good. To give an example, consider a blind person. Notice that what is evil here is not the blind person's eye, considered in and of itself, but the lack of sight in the eye. Blindness is the corruption of, or lack of, or privation of sight. Blindness is not a thing in and of itself, but is the very corruption of a thing. In light of this definition of evil, we must conclude that the uncaused cause is not evil, nor does this being contain any evil within its nature. For the uncaused being is being as such, pure actuality with no potentiality, and hence this being cannot have any corruption or contamination or defection or privation of any kind within its nature. If that were not enough, we must recall that the uncaused cause is truth itself. An intuition most of us share is that truth is an intrinsic good. Thus, truth itself must be all good, containing no evil within itself. Therefore, the uncaused cause is omnibenevolent, or all good. Before we move on, it may be best to clarify our position on the phenomenon of evil. Evil is not a negation of good, but a privation of a good that is owed. For example, the eye is for seeing. Therefore, every eye ought to see. So when we notice a blind eye, we note that the eye itself is not evil, but its privation is. On the other hand, knowledge is a good, but a rock is not meant to know. Therefore, the negation of the good that is knowledge with respect to a rock is not evil, but merely the absence of some good. Thus, withholding a good from a contingent being is not evil. Depriving a good owed to a contingent being in such a way that the being cannot be what it is meant to be is an evil. Okay? Well, there are objections to our definition of evil. Our definition of evil is taken from a modern dictionary as well as a respectable theological tradition. But how can we really know that it's true? That's the first question. How do we know that this is how we should define evil? We answer that a basic philosophical argument can be given for this definition of evil. Namely, premise one, good and evil are opposed to one another. Premise two, being is a positive term. Premise three, good and being are convertible terms. Therefore, conclusion, evil is nothing positive but a negation or a privation. The first premise that evil and good are opposed to one another is grounded in human intuition, for the most basic understanding of good and evil is that they are opposites. Premise two, that being is a positive term, is self-evident, for something is not nothing. Hence, being is not to be defined negatively but positively. Premise three, that good and being are convertible in the sense that every being is good and every good is being, at least this seems to be evident to more than a few individuals insofar as they see the preservation of their own being as a good. That's why we uphold that premise. And then fourthly, but if evil is opposed to good and if good is being, then evil is opposed to being, and hence evil is nothing positive but a privation of the good. In the words of Gregory Lagrange, good is everything that is desirable, but every nature desires to preserve its being and its perfection. Therefore, all being and every perfection is something good. And therefore, too, evil is not some being or some positive nature, but it is either the negation or the privation of a good. Here are some objections. Pain, which is an evil, is positive. A toothache, for example, is no mere privation. It hurts, and it is a positive hurt. Therefore, evil is not a privation of the good. Thomas Aquinas replies to this argument as follows. He says, just as two things are required for pleasure, namely the union with some good and the perception of this union, so two things are required for pain, namely the union with some evil, which is evil because it deprives of some good, and the perception of this union. Thus, pain, like pleasure, is a movement in the intellective or sensible appetite. Hence, pain, when it is in the sensitive appetite, is properly said to be the passion or suffering of the soul. And so, as Gary Lagrange says, pain and pleasure are contraries, and as pleasure is connected to some good act easily exercised, such as the grace of youth, so pain is connected with some act more or less impeded, or some immoderate act which produces fatigue. Hence, pain is not something privative, but it is connected with privation and arises from the perception of the union of some evil. The prophet Isaiah, here's another objection, rejected this definition of evil. It is written, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil." This sort of objection arises from the fact that if Augustine and Thomas are correct, then good is the subject of evil. That is to say, evil, since it is a privation of the good, in some sense resides in the good, and is therefore in some sense caused by the good. Indeed, only something that is a being can be the cause of anything, and evil must come from some cause, since every event, including an evil act, needs a cause. But evil is not a being, but a privation of being, and hence a privation of the good. Therefore, evil must be created by good. We respond that our definition is in perfect accord with Isaiah, for we have clearly distinguished good and evil. Good is not evil, and evil is not good. Good is positive, since it is being, and is to be desired for its own sake. Evil is negative, since it is a privation of being or good, and is to be avoided. Thus, our definitions here do not confuse good with evil, but rather presuppose the very distinction advocated by Isaiah. Jesus said good cannot cause evil, though. Jesus says, even so, every good tree bears good fruit, but the bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot produce bad fruit, nor can a bad tree produce good fruit. Now, I don't think that this is a correct interpretation of what Jesus is saying. I think that Jesus is talking about teachers, and he's saying that a teacher who has corrupt doctrine is not going to give good teaching and therefore bear good fruit. But assume the opposite. On page 172, I say assume the opposite. Assume that we have misunderstood Jesus here, and he is in fact talking about good never being able to produce evil or immoral deeds. How shall we respond? Our answer is that everyone is good insofar as he or she exists, but anyone who does evil must have a bad character which produced that evil deed, for evil can only come from evil. Hence, we make a distinction. All persons, insofar as they exist, are good, and since all persons are good, good people can do bad things. But all persons, insofar as their characters have become corrupted by bad decisions, are evil, and it's for this reason that evil deeds can be performed by all people. That is to say, all people are, in a sense, evil. Those who may oppose our position for its subtlety need to realize that the presupposition of the interlocutor entails an absurdity, at least from the Christian perspective. For if evil can only come from evil in an unqualified sense, and if good can only come from good, again, in an unqualified sense, then we must conclude that anyone who sins is purely evil with no redeeming qualities whatsoever. But everyone has sinned. Therefore, everyone is evil with no redeeming qualities whatsoever. No one then has ever produced a good thought, nor has anyone ever done anything good in any sense, since no good can come from evil. But a true idea is also a good one, as we have seen. Therefore, if our interlocutor's presupposition is true, then it is false. Are y'all seeing that? If you're saying that evil can only come from evil without any qualification, then if everyone has sinned and if everyone is therefore evil, then no person has ever done a good thing, including producing a good thought. But the interlocutor who's arguing against our definition of evil is a human being. Therefore, he is evil. Therefore, his own position, it has to be false, because no good can come from an evil, and vice versa. And it's impossible for anyone to accept our interlocutor's position, for accepting a truth is performing a good deed of sorts, but no one who is evil can perform a good deed. Therefore, no one can accept the interlocutor's position as true. Is God the cause of evil? This objection seems to follow from everything we have said. If evil is a privation of the good, and if evil is caused by being, which is convertible with the good, then evil must be caused by good. But God is the supreme good, therefore God must be the cause of evil. On the contrary, it is illogical to say that God is the cause of evil. For the one who is pure actuality has no privation or lack or negation in his being. But evil just is the privation of being. Therefore, evil cannot be caused by God. To be sure, evil is the product of a good, but it must be the product of a good that has potential to be other than what it is. The only reality that is both actual and potential is the contingent cosmos. Therefore, evil must have its ultimate origin somewhere in the cosmos, somewhere in the realm of contingent reality, not in pure actuality. And I'm going to end our discussion here. I think this is a good place to end. I know that the great counter response is, doesn't Isaiah say that God is the cause of evil? And that is what we're going to pick up next. But, you know, the other night you raised this question. How we were talking about the Westminster Confession, and you were like, the first humans were good but mutably so. I think that this is a metaphysical explanation for that very thing. They were created actual with potential because they are contingent beings. They are actuality and potentiality. So only an actual potential composition can even do something that tends away from the good, because only there can that sort of thing happen. You cannot have a purely actual being the cause of evil. And so that ends our discussion, and I'll see you guys in January.